From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. 200 years ago, America found itself on the eve of its Constitutional Convention, the process by which the aims and ideals of the Revolution were made politically explicit. What were the circumstances of life in the early Republic? How did Americans think about and express the beginnings of their national identity? Those questions are central to the following Soundings discussion. My guests are two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, both historians of 18th-century American society. Gary Nash is a professor at the University of California at Los Angeles. Thomas Slaughter teaches at Rutgers University. Gary Nash and Thomas Slaughter are the authors of various scholarly works about social development and cultural and political patterns in revolutionary America. According to Gary Nash and Thomas Slaughter, America upon the eve of its Constitutional Convention was a country of cultural contrasts and startling variety, both underscored politically by the phrase Novus Ordo Seclorum, a new opportunity for freedom for humankind. But in practical terms, 20% of the American population was enslaved, and many others on the American frontier lived in poverty and in constant fear of Indian attacks. Tom Slaughter from Rutgers and Gary Nash of UCLA. Our topic is America at the time when it's sort of creating itself. If we could pick a date here, it would be right around the time period of 1785, 86. What was the sense of social structure? We today talk about living in a classless society, and yet we have a strong sense of lower, middle, and upper. Tom Slaughter, how did that work in those days?
Well, here again, I think the critical element of the questions you're asking is the notion of variety.
Uh-huh.
I think place and certainly the differential between urban and rural settings, onto frontier at the end of the spectrum between the urban and frontier situation, is the way that you have to look at the answer to that question. If you came from Philadelphia, if you came from Baltimore, one of the eastern cities, you would find an experience that was entirely alien to you if you traveled more than 100 miles west.
Hmm.
The ability of Americans to relate to each other.
Or indeed 100 miles in any direction.
Pretty much, but yeah. the most drastic variety was the one moving from the urban past the Appalachian chain into the most rural, the most frontier areas.
Uh-huh.
Now, even the question of class, the variety, Gary certainly knows far more about the city experience, but even in the country, we think of the American rural experience as being, as you say, a classless experience. The range of economic situation on the frontier was always dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Give me a couple of examples of what you mean by the range of economic experience.
In western Pennsylvania, uh-huh. travelers who arrived there from Philadelphia, from Europe, in the 1780s, would be struck by two things. They'd be struck by the squalor, the dirt, the filthiness, of the condition under which most white people there lived. The typical frontier settler in the area that's now Pittsburgh would live in a shack that would bend with every breeze. He would have a leaking roof, would sleep on a floor that was infested by lice and would probably have not more than a bed of hay upon it. By contrast, in the same area, you would find a mansion, rarely, but you would find a mansion that was furnished entirely with European furnishings.
Mm.
That European-made wallpaper would have clocks that were made in France, would have Windsor chairs and desks and silver utensils with which to eat.
Tom Slaughter from Rutgers and Gary Nash from UCLA. Gary, follow up what Tom has just been saying. How did the citizens, Tom mentioned Philadelphia, how did they think of the local political authority? What form did it take?
Well, for people in the cities, and let's take the case of Philadelphia, the revolution had been a difficult experience. Mm-hmm. Class differences were growing greater as the revolution approached. There was a good deal of democratic yearning among people in the lower orders, an expectation of what the revolution might do to cleanse society, to end what they saw as the corruption of wealth, the institution of something pure, something perhaps more democratic, though they might not have used that word. But most people, I think, had some millennial yearnings and expected the revolution to reinstitute, bring about in America, a new social order. That didn't mean a classless order, but one in which there was a more general equality of wealth.
Let's come back, Gary Nash of UCLA and Tom Slaughter of Rutgers. Let's come back to this notion of the varieties of experience that Americans were going through at this this time on the eve of the Constitutional Convention. Let's talk about politics, for example. What would have been some of the varieties of political experience at that time?
Well, certainly the hope of people in the more rural areas was for the hand of government that Gary was just talking about to lay even more lightly, I think, on their lives than it had in the past.
And this would have been in contrast to what they had experienced under Great Britain.
Yes, I think so, and what they had experienced under their colony, now state, governments. Mm-hmm. When people on the frontier read the Declaration of Independence, what they hoped for was not just independence from a remote central government in England, but from their own state governments as well. Mm-hmm. You see people, even my favorite example is a fellow in Kentucky who stood up in what later became Kentucky, what was still part of Virginia, and drew from his pocket in the mid-1780s his own personal copy of the Declaration, which he apparently carried with him everywhere, waved it in front of this gathering of local people, and virtually line by line pointed out how every abuse that document claimed to have been wreaked upon America by Great Britain was continuing to be dumped upon people in Western Virginia by people in Eastern Virginia. So the quest there is for more independence. The area that later becomes Kentucky, what becomes Tennessee out of North Carolina, and throughout the frontier, there's the hope in the mid-1780s that the revolution will continue, will go farther, that there will be less centralized experience than there is in 1783.
Mm-hmm. So what we have, Gary Nash from UCLA, Tom Slaughter from Rutgers, is a sort of new political set of institutions, but we still have the weight of these economic precedents. Is that apples, oranges? Have I got that right, Tom?
No, there are two incredibly striking things about the history of this period. One is the extent to which it's an incredibly creative period. The Constitution, the Revolution itself, the politics that come out of it
and yet
are incredibly
stale,
creative,
right,
and new. But the issues, there's a continuity,
right,
to the problems that remain after the Revolution, and indeed the problems that exist after the adoption of the Constitution.
Well, if you could single out a sort of single problem that would have been characteristic, Gary Nash, Tom Slaughter, would it have been what? Money? Would it have been politics? Did one dominate, or is that am I pushing too much for an oversimplification there? What would the mixture have been like, Gary?
I would say that people, we're speaking of ordinary people, but that's the great mass of Americans in the mid-1780s. I think most people were concerned about how power and wealth was distributed.
Mm-hmm.
They saw that concentrated wealth would always lead to concentrated political power, and that the soul of a republic was a generally equal condition.
Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a miracle that America has done as well as it has politically and economically, because these are hauntingly familiar complaints about our social order, are they not? The distribution of money, the haves and the have-nots.
Well, and people at the time observed these continuities. It's not just us looking back in retrospect that create them for ourselves and for Americans of the 18th century. There were countless people who stood up in the 1780s and 1790s and said, well, what was this revolution about? Right. If it wasn't about the relationship between people, their representatives, and taxation, for example, what indeed has been the consequence of this revolution if we now have another strong central government that seems to be undertaking policies in behalf of an Eastern mercantile elite in many of the same ways that the British government had been in the 1760s when we rose against the Stamp Act, in the 1770s when we rose against horrible new policies that again brought the hand of government even more strongly down upon us, that the issues have not changed. There was a great sense, I think, of frustration among some people.
Gary Nash from UCLA, Tom Slaughter from Rutgers. Our topic is America on the eve of its own constitutional convention. Talk to me in grand strokes here. What was political discourse like? If you could pick a figure in American history or an incident, maybe a one, you know, isolated little time segment, how did Americans think and talk back and forth about politics in this time period? We didn't have, now help me here, we didn't have political parties. We had political groupings and aggregates. We had more, attitudes. How did all of that work, Tom?
We have the attitudes that are indeed the beginnings of what become something like political parties in the 1790s, where we could identify what are called Federalist and Jeffersonian Republican parties of a sort. They're not by any means identical to the sorts of political parties we have now.
Not institutionalized.
They're not institutionalized. Right. They don't have the same sort of convention operations and control that parties do now. But it's the beginnings of that. What Americans share in the realm of political discourse, I think, is the sense of government as and the relationship between people and their government as something of a balancing act. That what you have are different interests. You have the interests of the poor and the wealthy. You have the rich and the poor, and they would have seen it that way. And your attempt is to balance the different interests of society in a way that gives no single group either so much power or so much despair that you create a situation in which you have either revolution or tyranny. And that's the trick, that's the game, to balance political society in a way that meets at least minimally the basic needs and expectations of people who live within that society. The problem in the 1780s is that both the needs and the inflated expectations that many people have coming out of the revolution are not being met. And that's what the Constitution is an attempt to rebalance in some ways.
A line from Jefferson comes to my mind. People can't be free and ignorant at the same time. Were they? I mean, were they thought of themselves as free, and yet education in the United States certainly wasn't what it is today. Were they, Gary Nash, any more politically astute than we are today? Now, here's a terribly complicated question. We have TV, we have ways of communicating with one another, for example, that citizens on the eve of the Constitutional Convention would not have had. Maybe I'm asking you a question about human nature. But are we any better at talking about politics today than they were then at this very crucial period just before America sort of defines itself?
I doubt that we are. I doubt that we're more sophisticated at all. I think the process of living through a revolution, of raising a rebellion, of fighting a rebellion, of wiping the slate clean, and having to write on the slate a new set of political rules to live under.
That would have been very instructive.
If we had that today, we would all have a great lesson in constitutionalism, in political science, in the sociology of communities.
Tom Slaughter.
Gary's absolutely right. I think despite the fact that people may not have been as educated as Americans are today, they were remarkably more knowledgeable about the major issues of politics.
Was it a question of wanting to know more? Was it a question of urgency in the sense that we know that we're about to take these momentous steps? Was it that apparent, for example?
There was a sense of urgency. There was a sense of belief that things could be changed, that one could affect one's own political destiny, which I think is to some degree lacking today.
Yeah.
There was a great sense of the possibilities both for success and failure, for the opportunity of individuals to affect their own political destinies. So out of this sense of the significance of politics, there came both a hope and a great fear that Americans could blow it. They were very worried. Every political issue seemed to have a drama, a significance to it, that people were willing to lay down, if not their lives, at least a good bit of their fortunes upon. Mm-hmm. It meant more to people, perhaps largely because they did think that the possibilities, the range of possibilities, were so great.
Mm-hmm. Gary Nash from UCLA, Tom Slaughter from Rutgers. Our topic is America on the eve of its constitutional convention. Let me shift the focus of our discussion just a little bit. Tell me, again, in broad strokes, what did Americans think about politics and religion? Did religion enter into the political discourse of the time? Gary?
It did, but you've raised a very, very complex problem. On the one hand, the American Revolution sent many churches reeling into at least a temporary decline.
Mm-hmm. And why would that have been?
The disruption of communities, the end of state religion, where the Anglican Church was the church.
The formal relationship between the two.
Right. Every taxpayer had tithe, be tithed for the Anglican Church. So the disestablishment of the churches, and even the spread, at least among the upper middle and upper classes, of deism, enlightenment. But on the other hand, the revolution included strong millennial strains, and
this reflects that sense of expectation that that Tom Slaughter mentioned.
Exactly, and therefore we have the rise of the Baptists and the Methodists, who gain members, become the fastest growing and the newest churches in America, are evangelical, millennially tinged religious groups, and who have at the heart and soul of their belief the idea that Christian communities could be formed, new moral societies.
Tom Slaughter?
There's a sense of what you might call civic millennialism, where although God is not always the obvious and articulated reference point, that religious vision of the way the universe works was applied to the civic, to the public sphere, in a way that gave, and Americans recognized as giving a great parallel between religious and civic life. But this fear that Americans were a chosen people, and in certain sense, if not in the Puritan sense of that, certainly in a lingering sense, Americans did believe that they were a chosen people of sorts, which gave them both great responsibilities and great possibilities.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about American politics and culture during the period following the Revolutionary War. My guests are two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, both historians of 18th century American society. Gary Nash is a professor at the University of California at Los Angeles. Thomas Slaughter teaches at Rutgers University. According to Gary Nash and Thomas Slaughter, Americans on the eve of their Constitutional Convention gave social expression to the hopes and aims implicit in the phrase Novus Ordo Seclorum, the opportunity for new freedom for humankind. Yet for many Americans, everyday life during the late 18th century was characterized by the stark struggle for subsistence, the practice of slavery, and fearful survival on the American frontier. Speaking of contrasts, Gary Nash from UCLA, Tom Slaughter from Rutgers, let's conclude our conversation. Our topic has been America on the eve of its own creation, its constitutional convention. We haven't talked about race. Gary Nash, should we use a word as strong as hypocrite when we talk about the American founders and we say, look, they cooked up this country based on equality and liberty, and yet didn't have, what, somehow or other the political will or the ability to bring it off for this minority section of the population? Should we say that, or should we look at them and say, let's give them credit for at least, you know, putting the issue on the table in political terms? And then sort of what, turning it over to subsequent generations to figure out the answers.
Well, the temptation is to congratulate the North, where slavery was largely abolished in the Revolutionary era, and to criticize the South, where 90% of the slaves lived, for leaving the institution in place, leaving another generation to wrestle with the problem. We ought to resist that temptation. Uh-huh. It was a national problem. There could only be a national solution. Southerners have taken too much blame, I think. The fact is that Northerners of the Revolution, who led the abolitionist crusade here in its early stages, did very little to suggest that the North should be a part of the solution to this national problem. What do I mean by a solution? Well, some form of compensation to slave owners, mm-hmm. based on a national tax, based on the revenues from the sale of the Western lands, which were the Western lands of both the Northern and the Southern states, which went to the new national government. Mm-hmm. But some kind of national solution to a national problem. Mm-hmm. That was not forthcoming, and Northerners should bear as much of the burden as Southerners in this regard. Mm-hmm.
Tom Slaughter?
On the issue of Indian-white relations, one of the most dramatic examples I can think of an event that occurred during the mid-1780s, the time that we're talking about today, involved a very unenlightened frontier population that, in a fashion, I could only compare to what occurred in Nazi Germany, certainly not on the scale, but certainly of the kind of what occurred, marched to a Christian Indian village in what is today Ohio and systematically butchered the 150 Christian Indians who lived there.
Solely on the basis of race.
And the issue of the Indian's humanity in this case, as in many others, was not one that struck people deeply on the frontier. But again, the variety of American experience, the variety of enlightenment and sensitivity to the sorts of issues that Gary points out were raised during the revolutionary generation depended in many ways on where you lived, on the culture in which you were raised, and on your experiences. And I would have to say that on the issue of race, rural Americans, whether they were in the South and dealing with the issue of slavery, whether they were on the frontier and confronting Indians, were terribly unenlightened. Unenlightened in ways that are striking to us, because when we read the revolutionary notions of equality and the rights of mankind, we can't help but think about people of other races and indeed women's rights as well. These were issues that I think largely did not strike most people in America, although people of the intelligence and complexity of Thomas Jefferson certainly were racked by what they saw as the unfortunate complexity of these issues. But most Americans, I'm afraid, were not.
Let's conclude our conversation very quickly with a footnote here. What would you tell a general audience, Gary Nash from UCLA, Tom Slaughter from Rutgers, about the way people lived on the eve of America's Constitutional Convention when it was about to invent itself? Maybe you want to talk in comparative terms, how far we've come or how far we haven't come. Maybe you want to talk in terms peculiar to that time period. What sticks with you? What interests you? Gary, Nash?
Well, first I would say they lived simply. The rusticity of life, the struggle for existence, mm-hmm. Is memorable.
Tom Slaughter mentioned the problem of subsistence itself.
These are ordinary people, many of them scrabbling for a living. Mm-hmm. They don't fit the picture of America as a cornucopia in the 18th century. It's not that way at all. There are also people, I think Tom mentioned this before, people with a sharp anticipation of what might be possible. So though immediate difficulties beset them, there is a very considerable optimism nonetheless. And part of that is based on the fact that they live on the edge of a continent that they are just beginning to open up. There are the Indians who are these obstacles to their opening up of that land. And another thing I think that is memorable is that they are people, I think, pretty consistently racked with a fever of land. There's nothing, I think, that motivates a larger percentage of Americans on the eve of the Constitutional Convention than a reverence for land, a desire for land, a desire to get more of it, for the generations that will follow, for one's sons and grandsons, daughters and granddaughters, and so forth.
The creation of
land-hungry people.
Yeah. Tom Slaughter?
I think I would focus, and here I'm not differing with Gary's focus much at all, I would focus on the humanity of the people about which whom we're talking. I think our tendency in the past to portray this era in heroic hues has lost for us the sense of these people as very real people with very real problems who were confronting not the abstract but the very real events of their day. The ways in which they confronted these problems, or indeed the nature of the problems themselves, varied greatly according to class, place, gender, and race during the 18th century, as they such things differ today. But we do all these people a disservice when we lose sight of their very human needs and their very human attempts to confront the problems of their daily life. I am most saddened by the extent to which we have really lost such people as George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, in a sense, because we have painted them as very cardboard-like figures, when indeed they were men, and to portray them in their full color, both their idiosyncrasies and their prejudices, as well as their great strengths, is the only way, I think, to recover any meaning that exists for us in the people and events of the late 18th century. And that's what I think people like Gary Nash and what I hope to try to do, that's what many historians are engaged in today, trying to recover that era from the heroic and, frankly, quite boring portrayals of it that have been foisted upon us in elementary school.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about American politics and culture during the late 18th century, following the Revolutionary War, and on the eve of the American Constitutional Convention. The Soundings panelists were two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, Gary Nash of the University of California at Los Angeles, and Thomas Slaughter of Rutgers University. Gary Nash and Thomas Slaughter are the authors of scholarly books and articles about 18th century American society. For a cassette copy of Soundings on 18th century American culture, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation featuring one scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. W.R. Newell of the University of Nebraska will discuss his forthcoming study of Martin Heidegger, the 20th century German philosopher. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about American politics and culture during the late 18th century. What were the circumstances of life in the early republic? How did Americans think about and express the aims and ideals that became politically explicit in the Constitutional Convention? Some answers and insights from Gary Nash of UCLA and Tom Slaughter of Rutgers University. American Origins, Variety and Purpose, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.